Welcome to Friday. Welcome to the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. This is our time to spend an hour together getting caught up on the events of the week that matter to us with a little help from my friends. Charles Medede, writer for the Seattle Stranger. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you very much. Back in again.
Yes, it's good to have you again. Monica Guzman, co-founder of the Evergreen Newsletter.
Hey,
welcome.
Hey.
Hi. Rachel Lerman, tech writer for Seattle Times. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you all. Can we talk about guilty pleasures for a moment, if there is such a thing? Some people would say just do it or don't. Don't feel guilty. But I don't know. The day after Seattle's 4th of July fireworks show, volunteers on foot and in kayaks cleaned up 500 pounds of garbage from Lake Union. The rest of the junk is on the lake bottom. Fireworks result in fine particulates that burrow into your lungs and bloodstream, and the sparks start fires and the kids lose fingers. And Charles, is life not fun enough for you without scaring the dogs as you reenact a dreary ritual of performed excitement at the same old sparkle boom booms?
I don't want everybody to hate me, so I'm not going to answer that.
Okay. That's a way of, that's a good dodge. Just don't, you know, answer it.
It's a carnival. I mean, that's what it is. I think, you know, people like the idea of breaking the law and getting away with it. I mean, that's what it is, exactly, right? I mean, I think that if it wasn't illegal, then all the fun would be taken out of it. And so it's a carnival in that sense, that it turns the city upside down. So everybody gets to participate in criminal behavior with no fear at all.
So right? You think a little anarchy is a good thing in the bloodstream, or what?
Well, it's not that it's a good or a bad thing. The sad thing is that we need it. I mean, we need the release, right? I mean, I wish that we had another way of celebrating our big occasions in history and whatever. But but fireworks to me are just not. I'm not big into them, but I live with it. I can bear it. I really can.
You know who else isn't big into fireworks? My almost six-year-old son. He was so terrified, and one of the ways that I tried to soothe him was by saying, "Look how special it is that so many people are out here right now." And I was really feeling the truth of that. It's actually really special that so many people get together to watch something. And then fireworks, there's something about the fact that they tie us to the past, right? I mean, we're celebrating
rockets, red glare.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you start to sever those links to the past because you want to move beyond your rituals, there is a loss, you know. It may be worth it if there's a cost benefit, but I don't think we're there yet.
What do you think, Rachel?
I think that fireworks are fun. I think that people need joy and celebration, and I don't really have a problem with them. What I do have a problem with is when people start lighting them off at 11 a.m. on July 5th. Like, I think that we should make an informal pact that we're all going to let off fireworks for 2 hours when it gets dark on July 4th and then stop.
It's the Christmas discussion of when you start airing. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, there's also another problem. I mean, okay, to be honest with you, I never know exactly which time of the year I'm at, right?
So, really?
I don't. It's really hard for me because I have to take a moment for me to realize, oh, I'm in the middle of summer or I'm in the middle of winter or something like that.
You know what? I'm kind of like that, actually.
You know, right?
Truly.
Right. So the first thing that I hear on fireworks go off is just guns, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness, someone's getting shot. Then it takes me a while to recalibrate and I say, oh, wait a minute, tomorrow is the day when fireworks go berserk. And so I realize, oh, that's what they're doing.
Are you relieved or feeling depressed that was your reaction?
Well, I'm glad that it turns out that way.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I liked putting firecrackers in mailboxes as a kid, and then I was bored by it all for 30 years, and then I had kids, and it was fun again, and now my kids are getting older. It's time to ban fireworks. That's a good way to make policy, don't you think?
That's so logical. Wow.
Here's another guilty pleasure of summer, possibly. I was interviewing Seattle's mayor this week, Jenny Durkin, and we talked taxes and homelessness and streetcars, and a listener called in about this.
Hi, Bill. This is Janet Leonard, Seattle resident. I really appreciate your show, The Record.
A little plug for The Record in there. Thanks.
I have a question for the mayor, and that is I appreciate her climate initiative, and in that vein, I think the Blue Angels have outlived their currency, let's say. I would appreciate it if she could address the question of who says okay that the Blue Angels visit Seattle every year and why.
For your newcomers, this is a perennial debate that zooms low over our city once a year. And the Blue Angels are the naval precision jet flying team that roars over Lake Washington. As the caller said, they spew carbon and stop traffic and cost money and make noise. And she didn't even mention the militarization of Lake Washington. And this is how the mayor responded.
I've heard a lot of criticisms about the Blue Angel. In fact, in the you know, 80s and 90s here, we had so many immigrants and refugees in South Seattle who had experienced in war zones that it was troublesome. I will admit a great fondness myself to the Blue Angels. I think that they are a master in flight, in engineering, and humankind. I can see how other people don't like them. The carbon footprint is an issue, but I still, I hate to admit it, but I come down on the side of the Blue Angels.
She's coming down on the Blue Angels, on their side. Mm-hmm.
I think I'm going to be cranky and say that they're so loud. They're just so loud. And you can hear them from everywhere, and it sounds like something is like tearing apart the sky. Yeah.
Can we imitate the sound?
Ooh. That was really good.
But it actually lasts a while.
Yes. Yeah. Longer than a human breath can take. That's true.
I rarely agree with anything that Durkin has to say, but in this case I do. But for a different reason. I don't find it as, you know, as pleasing as she does. I think that it's important for us to hear the military and what it feels like. I think that we live in a huge we live in a country with a huge military budget. We're only miles away from nuclear weapons, right? We have, you know, this is don't act as if this is not a part of our society. I think Seattle should accept the fact that a big chunk of our economy is wrapped up with this kind of technology, this kind of power, this kind of destructive force. So I am all for, you know, seeing it, feeling it, and understanding it, and not acting as if it doesn't exist.
But do you get a sense of destruction when the recreational Blue Angels flying over?
Oh,
you
I get
feel
a,
it.
I get a sense they're going to blow my house up.
Oh my.
Blow my snow. I'm not kidding you. I mean, how else are you supposed to feel when those things come down, except that you're the target?
Oh, my God. Well, as someone for whom the Blue Angels are actually in my wedding photos, we got married on the day that they were flying over and took pictures, and boom, there they are.
You got photobombed by a Navy jet.
We did, happily.
Yeah,
happily.
The nice kind of bomb.
Yeah, I remember on a previous show, we talked about beauty contests.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was thinking about how beauty contests are one of those things that other places in the country generally appreciate more than Seattle.
Yeah. Mm.
And I think the same is true of the Blue Angels. I think it's a bit of an awkward mismatch, right? Mm. Because there's other places that are, you know, in America and that celebrate this, where this conversation would be laughed at.
Right.
You know,
right.
But we are in Seattle, and this is not a very military culture type place.
Now, I once did a piece about Tacoma and its relationship with the Air Force Base and the military and the Army base there. And I interviewed an elderly woman who was really near the Air Force Base, right? I mean, she heard all of the planes going over her house. And I asked her, how do you deal with it? And she said, it's the sound of freedom.
Ooh. Yeah.
Oh, I kind of like that.
Yeah, there's something mythical to that.
I do think that it helps that we have Boeing here. We have the Museum of Flight. We have such a long history of aircraft that people kind of revere the Blue Angels. I mean, I remember hearing about them from when I was, you know, 5 years old. So exciting. People would go out to watch them. Mm-hmm. Did you plan to have your wedding on the same day?
No, not at all. Oh, okay. No. Not that much of a nerd for the Angels. But still, you know, I get to. It's a little conversation piece.
How did you feel about Blue Angels on your wedding day? Was that like Alanis Morissette ironic? Was that
no,
just think
it was
fantastic?
It was great. I think
you don't talk. Charles, look at me quizzically. It's like Blue Angels on your wedding day.
We're gonna do sound effects. We're gonna do songs today.
That's,
it's gonna be great.
It's Friday. Okay, so Blue Angels are staying. They're coming again in about a month, August 4th. 4th and 5th.
I'm
telling you in advance. The crows?
The crows are insane.
They go nuts when the Blue Angels come. I'm not kidding you. They really are affected by it. And if you know what I mean, they would want them out of the town, not around.
Well, for some people that would be a feature. There's a lot of crow resentment, I think, among humans. We feel very competitive toward that's one of the species that might be have it in for us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so sorry crows, Blue Angels are a month away. So, but Charles, I'm just letting you know in advance. Put it on your, because I'm kind of like you. I exist out of time. So don't be scared and don't take it personally, okay, when they're screaming. Another possible guilty pleasure. You tell me. This week, Seahawks star Cam Chancellor retired from playing. He says a nerve injury in his neck that he got on the field leaves him at risk for paralysis. And he tweeted, pray for your boy. I have no clue how these head injuries will go after the game. We've all heard about players and brain injury. Most recently, Washington State University's quarterback, Tyler Helinski, killed himself, and the autopsy showed he had extensive brain damage that's been linked to concussions from playing football. If you watch football, Seahawks, Huskies, are you complicit? Are you guilty?
I don't think anything is going to change unless we, everyone in the country, is kind of a big driving force, stops watching it, because right now it's just too big of an entertainment force. It's too big of a moneymaker. It's just too entrenched. I will be the first to say that I know very little about sports. I don't really watch sports. And so I'm probably, you know, going to be ridiculed for weighing in on this because I just can't.
That's a humble brag. That's a humble brag because yeah, yeah. You're also, your conscience is clean. Your hands are clean.
Right. Oh, that's true. That's right.
I'm innocent.
Above the,
yeah. Raising
but
my hands.
I will say that there are many other sports that achieve the entertainment and community factor without the extensive brain damage. And I wonder if there's a way to kind of shift society toward one of those.
Like rugby?
Well, rugby actually does have less brain damage, right?
Really?
Because the tackling, somebody was explaining to me that the tackling, the way you tackle in rugby is very different than football because you're not wearing pads and helmets and things like that, so you actually protect your head more.
You're not going to spear somebody at full velocity.
Actually, I know rugby very well.
Yeah?
Yes, I do. And I can tell you that high tackling is a foul. You can't tackle somebody high.
You have to
always tackle at the low, the legs.
It brings up an interesting question, which is violence part of the pleasure? You know, is one of the reasons that American football is the most money-making, you know, high-octane sport in America and on the entertainment value as well, because violence is part of the pleasure? I mean, you can think back to the gladiator days. You know, we've always wanted somehow to watch that, but I think I would hope that we don't, that we could, that if that is something innate in us, that it's not real and we've just gotten used to it.
I think you made a, this is exactly, I think, where sort of the common American would sort of disagree with you in this comparison with gladiators. I mean, you got to remember, those were slaves often. They were not paid anything and so on. The American thinks, like, we pay a lot of money for this. And you're going in there and you're getting paid a lot of money to do this.
Right.
You have made a decision that I'm going to receive this huge paycheck, right, at a risk, right? And so there's, I think that there's very little sympathy for the players after receiving, say, $1 million paychecks, you know, dream of a lifetime paychecks, right? And then suddenly you want to go and complain about your head being hurt and so forth.
Well,
and
no,
so
no, but that's exactly what's so significant about the moment now, because we've been talking about this for years in some level, but it kind of started with scientists and outsiders, and now it's football players themselves talking about their own safety and wanting to get out of the game and, you know, pray for my boys. I mean, that's a huge leap, because now the football players are going, maybe this wasn't such a good idea.
Yeah, maybe I should have just, you know, done the job, you know, done packages or something at the Amazon factory there.
Mm.
I mean, there's all these other opportunities for me to make lots of money in the USA. No, I don't.
Right.
I'm just sorry. I'm going to go with the common American and say, you know, the devil's bargain, right? It's made out. It's clear to you what you're getting into. Maybe the problem is that we don't have enough opportunities for a lot of young people, you know, usually of color, to become successful in society, and they have to turn to football. For me, one of the biggest problems with American football is it's overrepresented by black people. You know, there's like, you know, I think it's around 70% of the players are black and so on. But there's a reason for that. I mean, the opportunities for blacks, you know, youth particularly, are often closed. And, you know, and those that are involved professional sports, they see people of their kind doing very well. And so they, you know what I mean? They take it as a realistic chance at success in this given society. So I have that other side of the picture. But the money is at the center of this issue.
I do think that sports can be really good for young people to help, you know, teach how to work in a team and all of these great skills. But I agree that you are taking on a risk of physical harm when you play a sport, especially professionally. But I think the research is fairly new enough on brain damage, on CTE in football players, that this is something that's kind of relatively coming to a conscious now. Like maybe, oh, you're taking on the risk of breaking a leg or getting a sprain, or even something as bad as, you know, losing use of a limb, but I don't think that you were taking on this extensive brain damage that we are just recently learning about.
Yeah.
Does anyone think that watching the Huskies, the Seahawks, is that something you do, shouldn't do?
Mm.
Are you complicit? How do you come down? What's your part in it?
Yeah, I don't think you can deny that there's cognitive dissonance happening. If you are watching and you are concerned for the players, but you're watching anyway, then I think you are complicit. You know, what I won't say is that you're, you know, bad person or evil, because there's something about complicities that is shared so universally, you know,
right,
that makes
implicated.
It more of a social obligation to overcome than an individual one. And so I think what we have to do is, you know, both wait and push the culture forward. And who knows whether that will happen with bit by bit, one by one individuals no longer watching. I don't think so. I think the culture needs to move a little bit farther along. More of these players quitting, more of the science being in the mainstream, more movies being made about it before individuals actually feel like, oh yeah, it's too much.
Movies that don't star Will Smith, by the way.
Mm. Why?
Boxing?
It wasn't a very good performance.
Oh, I didn't watch it.
Wait, yeah. What was it?
It was a movie about this.
About that subject.
I missed it.
I think it was called Concussion. Oh, I think they kept it really clear as to what the subject matter is. I have to, again, I'm not the kind of person who, I'm a fair weather fan, okay? So I can't answer this question, because if the team is losing, it's easy for me not to watch.
Well, there's something else you can feel guilty about. You're a fair weather fan.
Mm-hmm.
So, go on.
Tisk, tisk.
Well, the state of Illinois, I know, proposed and backed away from banning tackling under the age of 12. The quarterback, Brett Favre, former star quarterback, he came out in support of don't let the kids tackle. I don't know where Washington State is on that, but that could be on the list of things you mentioned about society moving in that direction. Now, by the way, this is the Week in Review on KUOW Seattle, and we have Rachel Lerman here from the Seattle Times and from Evergrey, Monica Guzman, and from The Stranger, Charles Medede. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW, so jump on with us at KUOW, and we're talking here about guilty pleasures, which are kind of all over the news this week because, for example, the Seattle Times interviewed a writer who worked undercover at an Amazon warehouse in Britain. James Bloodworth describes Amazon workers peeing in bottles so they can keep working and hit their productivity targets under Big Brother-ish type surveillance.
When you go into the warehouse, when you like arrive at the beginning of your shift, you first of all swipe your card to show that, you know, so you get paid. And then you'd go to a desk where you pick up everyone picks up a handheld device, you plug the battery in and you log in. And then what it does is that directs you for your entire shift, you know, where you have to go. So as soon as you scan the first item, wherever it sent you, then a timer kind of starts. And then you have to reach your next item before the timer reaches, like an egg timer, before that runs out. And with that, then they would monitor your productivity. So someone came round to me the first week and told me that I was in the bottom 10%. Of productivity. Also, you'd receive messages through it. So, you know, speed up, you need to get your productivity up, or messages, you know, more kind of anodyne messages, such as, you know, there's more overtime available.
Okay, so as you consider whether you should feel guilty about shopping at Amazon, does that sound like a dystopia, or does that sound like your employer requiring you to do the work that they're paying you to do?
I think it's always good in cases like this to understand the baseline, right? I mean, warehouse culture has, I think, manufacturing has often run on the gospel of productivity and efficiency. The difference today, of course, is that you have technology that can put surveillance at scale and in very granular ways for each individual worker. Now, Amazon has always been a company that, you know, makes its revenue by a lot of little things being put at scale. So I can see how, you know, one more minute that something takes for one worker times 100,000 workers times, you know, that's a lot of loss. So it's a company that is so big and for whom scale matters so much that I understand why they would want granular control on warehouse productivity. So that to me is sort of the baseline. Then the question becomes, well, are they going too far?
Yeah.
And, you know,
it's one thing to surveil in order to get to hit your productivity targets, but then maybe the next question is, well, how reasonable are the productivity targets?
Right. And who gets to decide?
Yeah.
And I wonder about motivation too. Like, is the only way to motivate this productivity by having a device that's saying speed up, move faster. I imagine it in a robot voice for some reason.
All you have to do is watch Charlie Chaplin's film. You have
that's right. Modern Times.
Yeah,
it's a great movie.
The machine says that. Actually, it gives commands. It barks out commands. Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if there's another way to do that, if it's through employee culture or if it's through incentives, or I'm not sure. But I do wonder a little bit, because I agree, right? Warehouses have always run on productivity, and they kind of have to. But how do you ensure that?
Right, and that it isn't abusive, it's not exploitative.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's interesting because nothing has really changed. I mean, this has been with us for at least the past 200 years. I mean, we can go back to the pin factory in Adam Smith's founding document, The Wealth of Nations. It's there. It's there in, of course, it's there in Das Kapital by Marx. It's there in Modern Times, Taylorism. We always believe that we've made some important changes to the way our economy works. And then we go and find out that the leading sort of model of the future corporation, right? You know, the sort of cutting edge Amazon is not that different from Ford factories 100 years ago. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's interesting to have that realization, to be sobered mm-hmm. by this description, and you're like, wow, this sounds like a factory inspector out of the 19th century going in and seeing a bunch of workers suffering underneath the regime of the machines. I mean, it's absolutely impressive to me.
If they had a choice, wouldn't these companies employ robots not humans at all? And so then the question is that dystopian, or is that a future of humans instead doing far more interesting and less mechanized work?
Yeah.
And they do employ robots, right? Amazon has
those
little Kiva robots that are kind of square and shuttle around all over mm-hmm. the floor.
Well, humans are still a touch cheaper than those robots, and so they still need them to do all this work. Yeah. I mean, they are doing robot work. I mean, the idea that you have a device that tells you where to go and what to do, it just means that, they also need the human brain there to work effectively. Yeah. But I'm just saying that it's really fascinating. I mean, Amazon is really, you know what I mean? It has a market capitalization which is out of this world at the moment.
Approaching Apple's now.
Apple's at the moment. It replaced Apple as the, you know what I mean? As the company of the future. That's what I meant to say, right? Mm-hmm. It's in that sense. And then you have Jeff Bezos walking with robot dogs and whatever. You have all these, you know, the trappings of like, you know, the talking, the Alexa and all this. It seems to be very futuristic, right? And that's the way they like to present themselves, right? And then you get a report, and again, you're like, wow, nothing has really changed. Mm-hmm. We're still doing things the same way. We're trying to extract as much value as we can out of the worker, you know, the all this timetable stuff. It's not. I mean, check in, check out. I mean, I think in a sense, we sort of, in my generation, right? In my generation, which hasn't been in unions and that sort of thing, we sort of came into the world and we sort of believed that, you know, the office was uncool. You can come in when you want. And you know what I mean? That you could mm-hmm. do work at home in your bed and all this sort of thing. And mm-hmm. so this was sort of a myth, right? And then when you turn around and you're like, no, actually most of our society does not do that kind of, or operate or go to, or work in that way, right? Most of our society actually works in the way that factory is. And it's in the West. It's in a first world country. We're not talking about Bangladesh or anything. Lord knows what's going on there. This is a person who went into a factory in one of the richest countries in the world. That's and so, I mean, going to Kent as well. I mean, my goodness. And it's sobering. That's what I like about it. It's sobering. Yeah. It takes you, go and look at the Bezos spheres. and reflect on that. You know, after reading that article, go and see those fears, and you realize the myth and the reality are not.
Yeah,
the
there's
same.
A legal and regulatory question about this too, because you know, to your point, this has been going on forever. Companies working at efficiency, and usually, what prevents abuse or exploitation is knowledge and awareness, and then some kind of restriction placed on the corporation. And I think like. That's been slow to come because oftentimes we still sort of believe everything's kind of the same. But I think in a lot of ways, Facebook, Amazon, Google, Apple have shown us that no, things that happen at this scale and with this technology bring up all new issues. And we need to revisit these questions and make sure that people are being protected.
So these stories.
Richard Lerman, tech writer at Seattle Times, yes?
These stories come up and we hear from people that say, well, I'm going to stop using Amazon or I don't use Amazon, which is an interesting thing for me because it's getting harder and harder not to. to use Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you decide...
Why is that?
There are more online sellers. So you can decide to buy all of your things in physical stores, or maybe you buy everything from Etsy. You can ignore them in that way. But Amazon is in so many other businesses. Amazon now owns Whole Foods. Amazon AWS is the largest cloud computing platform in the world, which means it runs Netflix and Yelp. And it's the infrastructure that's supporting all of these other websites that we don't even think about, right? Because when I go to stream something on Netflix, I'm not like, oh, I am using AWS to stream this television show. But
good point.
But you are. And so if I think that you can decide, and we hear from people who say, I have decided not to buy anything on Amazon, and people definitely do that. But Amazon is becoming, and has been for quite some time, a very varied company that's in a lot of different businesses.
Yeah, the answer is it's precisely the same theme. It's efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Consumers also want to be efficient. Our lives are faster than ever. And the reason that I feel like I can't not shop at Amazon is because I don't have the time to look at other sellers. I don't have the time to figure out like who else is selling this or that. It's all on Amazon.
We do have the. Whenever I think I don't have the time, I try to check myself.
We can make it, but it costs us.
That's right.
Just as it would cost Amazon to have a nicer culture for its workers. It's all about efficiency ultimately, and we're not innocent.
Well, to me, okay, efficiency, fine, but. Here's where something like Obamacare comes into play. You know, people don't discuss Obamacare. They talk about Obamacare as being, about health care and health certainty or, insurance and so on. But if you went and looked at what it did, in a sense, this was sort of, I think they did a study of this in California, and it was revealed that people, if they knew they could have health insurance at low cost, they could take more risks in their lives, meaning that they would take business opportunities or take risks in entrepreneurial ideas and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, a lot of people who are working in these factories, if they lose their job, it's catastrophic, right? There's nothing really else out there that you can do. I mean, you need health insurance. You need all these other structures that make life livable, or has a distance from a situation which could bankrupt you in a matter of weeks. Right? And this is where we live. We live in a world where there isn't anything outside of work. You have to go into these factories, and you have to do this ridiculous amount of work, and you can't dream. You can't go out and say, oh, what if I wanted to start a website of my own and so on, and, I have some good idea, let's see how it goes. But you can't. So we're stifled. That's my position.
One more Amazon note before we leave and talk about other things. This week, the Washington Post reported that Amazon shoppers can buy white supremacy symbols like a swastika necklace, a baby onesie with a burning cross, a child's backpack featuring a neo-Nazi meme, Pepe the Frog, all in contradiction of Amazon's policy against selling products that promote hatred. Do you think, Rachel, you're a tech writer, do you think it's that Amazon just can't turn down those huge piles of neo-Nazi cash, or is it more like, well, they don't police that hard. They wait until somebody brings it to the public's attention.
I think it's probably the latter.
Yeah.
I think that Amazon has so many third-party merchants that are clamoring to sell on its site. I think more than half of the items sold on their site last year came from third-party merchants. So they're certainly not hurting for people to sell on their site. And they do have these guidelines that the merchants has to follow, and these seem to go pretty clearly against that. My guess, and I really don't know for sure, but my guess is that they have people monitoring this and just can't get to literally everything. Think about the mass quantities of things that are sold on Amazon. And we've seen it happen before. There was something earlier this year. It was something promoting slavery, products that were being sold on Amazon. And once it came up, Amazon pulled them down. So I think it might be something where they wait for it to come to their attention if they haven't caught it first.
You know, Walmart, was a boycott Walmart this week as well on Twitter? Did anybody follow that?
I didn't see that.
Yeah, no, on the other end, they're selling, apparently, in their stores, hats about impeaching.
Oh, yeah. Impeach 45.
I remember that.
And so there was this move.
Meaning the 45th president.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they can sell the Make America Great Again caps, but that's no problem. But if you sell impeach president, 45, that's a problem.
I think that's just one of the things that happens when you have so many businesses that reach so many people, is the public becomes part of your quality assurance.
Right.
It's just, that's the mechanism.
The public watchdog.
Outrage becomes part of the business.
You're listening to The Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke with Monica Guzman, Charles Medede, Rachel Lerman, and you're enjoying today's show, right? Wouldn't it be, what if we could do it live and in person? Like, for example, what we're doing, again, on Thursday night, we're going to tape A Week in Review. We've been on the road this summer taping the show. We went to Bainbridge Island and Bellevue, and so this coming Thursday, 12th of July, we're in Bothell at the McMenamins Anderson School. So come see us. Doors open at 6, free tickets, but just reserve your seat by going to KUOW.org/engage. Engage. We hope to see you there. And The Week in Review continues in just a moment. It's The Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Let's continue with the news. A new gun control initiative is coming to your fall ballot, probably. They say they have the signatures for Initiative 1639, which would raise the legal age to buy a semi-automatic weapon to 21 years old, require enhanced background checks and training and waiting periods to buy those weapons, require gun owners to secure their firearms. You could face a misdemeanor or even a felony charge if someone prohibited from getting a gun gets a hold of yours. Big funders, Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen, venture capitalist Nick Hanauer. Do we assume that this is going to pass? Gun control initiatives tend to do pretty well in Washington State.
My assumption would be yes, just based on the history of how well they've done. When was the last big one? 4 years ago now?
I don't remember. Yeah, I don't know.
I think it's been about 4 years, which is kind of crazy to think about. But it's requiring bigger background checks, a higher age in order to buy things. I don't think that it's something that we've seen people in Washington object to before.
Yeah, I think it's going to probably pass. And but, you know, I mean, it's far from enough. I'm going to say that. I mean, I'm glad it brings awareness to the problem, and that's important. And also, it means it shows. I mean, it shows that something can be done and should be done about it, and keeps it in the public discourse. I mean, at best, that's where I see it.
My biggest curiosity is just, you know, because we're speaking in Seattle from the perspective of being in Seattle.
Right. This is a Washington State initiative. That's
yeah,
very true.
Yeah, I'd be real curious to hear, you know, what the general perspective is in other parts of the state, because, yeah, we may not have a gun culture, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist or that there aren't, you know, things to kind of love about it. Plus, also, obviously, this bill is also just, if you strip away the kind of content around guns, it's also just, you know, individuals used to be able to make these choices, and now the government is putting more restrictions on individual choices about this activity. And so politically, that can be fraught, you know, for folks. So.
Yeah, a waiting period or a background check might come off differently to someone, a gun rights activist or a gun user in Eastern Washington than being told you're going to face a criminal charge if you don't secure your gun in your home. Your home is the key.
Yes,
that part is interesting. There's a law about what you do in your home with something you own.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
What about a second November initiative? Again, it looks like it's on the way, a carbon fee on fossil fuels emissions, so oil refineries, natural gas, power plants, with the money paying for clean energy, clean water, projects to slow climate change or help cope with climate change. This one, there was one that failed in 2016, but it was divisive among environmentalists, which this seems to be a little different, more of a united front among environmentalists.
Yeah.
That's what's interesting to me about this is when we think about Washington State, we think, oh, so environmentally friendly. We have all the forests. Everybody's so outdoorsy. So, of course, the carbon tax is going to pass. But the one in 2016 got 41% of the vote. It did not do well at all. Yeah. And it's precisely because of that. The environmental groups came down on opposite sides of it. They could not decide on what was the best way. They agree mostly on the outcome, right? But they couldn't decide on what was the best way to regulate that. But in this case, from what I'm seeing kind of initially, it seems like the big environmental groups are on the same side. So I wonder if it will have a different
fate. Yeah, it felt like it was round one, you know, fail. Here's round two. And they're building a more solid coalition. It sounds like one of the key differences is that this time it's a fee instead of a tax. And apparently that means a fee can be applied more narrowly, right? And I think some folks might have been concerned that a tax could end up getting pulled into things that it wasn't really intended for.
Mm-hmm. And also there's just a lot, I mean, I understand in the coalition itself, there's more diversity than there was in the first bill. So they actually it was shaped with different members of the community, and in that sense, it wasn't so homogenous as it was back in 2016. So I think it's got a good chance in that respect.
Then there's the coalition against it, the no on 1631. I was reading in the Seattle Times about the political action committee formed by the Western States Petroleum Association with pledges from BP, Shell, Chevron, Phillips 66, and other
and a bunch of dinosaurs. And,
yeah. We'll see about that one. Also in the news this week, the price of a home in King County is finally falling. The median home price in June, $715,000 across King County. That's actually down from the record high set in May. Seattle Times reports more homes are coming on the market. Homes already on the market are sitting around longer. Open houses might have 15 shoppers instead of 100 shoppers. Rents have stopped rising as well as new apartments come onto the market. Vacancy rates are up. Landlords offering freebies to get tenants in the door. Is this proof that developers and construction, that's the key to making Seattle affordable?
I think supply is, right? One way or another, you have to have supply that meets demand for the market to slow down. And to the extent that this could be a signal that supply is up high enough that the market is not so hot, then yeah, I would love to call it good news. Probably doesn't sound like, you know, you can claim victory on Seattle not being insanely expensive yet. I mean, obviously, we would need to see this for a long time. We've still had the hottest housing market for 20 straight months.
20 months in a row.
And that's a lot to recover from.
No, we're not going down. And it's not good news for anybody who is poor or working class or even middle class. The really big problem is, in order for prices to be to drop to sort of affordability levels, you'd need a whole crash of the system, which means you'd be out of work. So there's a built-in contradiction. So this is okay, but you know, the supply and demand economists kept saying that we can stuff the if we build and build and build and build, the price of homes will fall and become more available to people who are, you know, who are in the middle classes and the working classes. But we have a long way to drop to get to that kind of place. And you don't want that kind of drop from where we are. That's going to be painful.
And I think the word affordable is very relative, right? We've been growing and growing and growing for 20 months. These houses are pretty much affordable to very few people. I think we have a tendency to in Seattle to say, oh, the people that are moving here for jobs at tech companies, they make so much money. And yes, relative to other industries, the salaries are high. But these are still mostly young people with student loans who don't really have home buying experience. And so these houses are becoming unaffordable to the vast majority of people. And I don't know that would have to go way, way down before we see a big shift in that.
Yeah, you also wonder if some of these market signals may have something to do with just consumer habits changing, people kind of giving up and looking farther out. And then suddenly there's like a little bit of lag, you know, in the Seattle market, but it may come right back. We don't know.
And I understand that, 26% of the apartments right now in Seattle, the new apartments are empty?
If I'm correct.
Downtown.
Yeah. That's, you know, we have a houseless, you know, a homeless crisis at the same time as a housing crisis. And so it's interesting to me. I don't believe that they would drop prices in order to fill those empty spaces. I have a suspicion, and I can predict this, that prices will drop a little bit, but not much. It would be better. I suspect that those who own these developments would prefer to keep prices high and rather than fill in empty spaces. That's my prediction.
Well, sometimes when it comes to selling property, people hear that hey, maybe prices are falling and there could be a rush to get in. Well, this is the time to cash in. Mm-hmm. By the way, we're talking about, you know, bad news for people who can't afford a home. And on the flip side, this is a retirement dream for somebody who they're concerned about getting their money while they can. And they didn't necessarily buy decades ago. Maybe it was more recently, but we're watching these things when all of a sudden you never know how real estate markets turn when you feel like it's the getting's good. And by the way, a sign of the times in the Bay Area, San Francisco, San Mateo, and Marin counties, the federal government now classifies a family of four earning up to $117,400 as low income when it comes to eligibility for housing assistance programs.
Real. Yeah.
In Seattle, Bellevue area, it's about $80,000. Classify a family four as low income. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. We're going to come back and talk about whether Seattle businesses ought to have the legal right to discriminate against you based on your political beliefs. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Week in Review on KUOW with Charles Medede, writer for The Seattle Stranger, Monica Guzman, co-founder of the Evergrey newsletter, Rachel Lerman, tech writer for The Seattle Times. And we have been debating nationwide whether it's okay to make people feel unwelcome at restaurants and other businesses. That Virginia restaurant, the Red Hen, refused to serve White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and that had the CBS host Stephen Colbert concerned.
I believe everyone should follow their own conscience, and I can understand why some people might celebrate this restaurant owner doing this. But denying service to people you don't agree with is a slippery slope. Because pretty soon, we would just have liberal-only restaurants and conservative-only restaurants. And it'll be a nightmare finding a place where your whole family can eat. Honey, hey, honey, I found a moderate Taco Bell out by the airport we can take your mother to. They promised me the chalupas have no position on import tariffs.
Now, Virginia restaurants are allowed to refuse service based on a customer's politics, but Seattle businesses cannot do that. There's a city law against it. On the local news site Crosscut, writer Nate Christensen says, change the law. Do you want Seattle businesses to be legally able to discriminate against someone based on their political beliefs?
Personally, I would say, you know, we need to be able to not just eat with these people. We need to be able to see them and fight them. So it gives us an opportunity to confront them directly. So, you know, I mean, otherwise, I mean.
So you need a battleground? You want to make sure the battleground is open? My goodness.
Food fights.
I mean, this week you had a Pruitt, right, in that restaurant, right? Mm-hmm. Now imagine if there was some kind of ban on where he ate, that the mother couldn't have confronted him while he was eating. So I see the advantage of it. Oh, there he is right there. I'm going to go and confront him.
There's no better example to me of how personal politics has gotten than the fact that it is now a somewhat popular form of protest in D.C. to send text messages, right, to your group of advocate friends and go, so-and-so political figure is at this place. Let's go hassle her.
It can feel like an ascent if you see someone and you don't tell everybody, hey, so-and-so's right here. Well, are you quietly endorsing
it's
them?
It's amazing. So what's happened there is, I think, you know, it's somebody's job, it's who they are, it's what, you know, what they represent, and it's all one big just, you know, you think this, you do this, you represent all of these awful things to me, and I see no boundary for you that I can't cross into. That to me is a very
well not no bound. It's not physical violence.
I can't come into your house, maybe, hopefully, right. But right. I will if I see you at a restaurant. I will call my friends and we'll all get up in your face.
Well, apparently, this law originally, the Seattle law, was to prevent housing discrimination, according to Councilmember Nick Licata. But would you want a law? You know, we have rules against discriminating based on protected classes, of which, in most places, political beliefs is not one. Would you want a change in that law in Seattle?
Well, the writer made the argument that, you know, often the things that are protected, that you can't discriminate against, are things people can't really choose.
Right. But skin color, views, gender,
yeah,
characteristics you're born into.
Right. Political views you choose.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. So is that really even in the scope of things that we should be regulating? Plus, I would say, I think you always have a more honest society when people behave toward each other, you know, a certain way because they want to, not because they have to. So, I don't know. Yeah.
I do think there's a divide between public figures and the general public here. Yeah. Because the examples that we're talking about in D.C. or in Virginia involve public figures, people who have been elected or appointed to serve the public, versus if you see somebody wearing a Make America Great Again hat in a restaurant, can you throw them out? I think that becomes a very different discussion between somebody who has chosen to be in the spotlight and somebody who very much has not.
Don't our actions have consequences? I mean, why is there a bright line there.
Right. Oof.
Sure. I mean, yes, I think our actions have consequences. And I also think there's probably a difference between somebody going into a restaurant and starting to yell about political beliefs.
Right. That is different.
Versus just wearing maybe, you know, something that says who you support as a candidate and eating your lunch quietly. So I agree with you. I'm not sure if we need a law. Wouldn't it be better if people just did it by themselves? And I didn't know this law existed, so are people just doing it by themselves? Does everybody else know about the law?
Well, there, everybody knew about
it.
Yeah, there was a gym, a health club in Fremont that banned a neo-Nazi mm-hmm. or a white supremacist mm-hmm. who the company, the health club, said, yeah, he hadn't been being obnoxious in our gym, but first of all, maybe his presence would adversely affect other dues-paying members, mm-hmm. and also just his ideology that's just antithetical to what we right. believe, we, the private owners of this gym. Yeah. And apparently, if the guy had contested this, he probably would have won. I mean, this was in violation of mm-hmm. Seattle law, but he didn't.
Which brings up
he doesn't want to be at the gym anymore either.
It brings up another interesting distinction, right, which is the sort of degree to which maybe someone's views approach a dangerous extreme. And I think a lot of people have different places where they put that line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think for some people, just voting a certain way is a dangerous extreme by itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that puts a lot of people in the category of extremist.
Right.
A lot.
Right.
So, you know, be mindful of that, I suppose.
I'm sorry, we just have an extreme president right now. And it's really hard for me to, you know, understand. Everybody sort of plays this game about the law and whether or not we should, you know what I mean, if it's right or if it's wrong. But the problem is the left didn't push politics to that extreme, to that extent right now. And we're having to face this messaging. We have to face these people often who, given the chance, would do awful things to people of color. I mean, right now we have the situation on the border, which is just, to me, the worst thing imaginable. And as to anybody who's aligned with that kind of, you know, a belief that sort of thinks that's okay, right? I mean, I don't want to eat with them. I won't lie. I mean, I don't want anything to do with these people. And to me, I mean, I feel very strongly about this. It's not consistent with the notions of freedoms and so forth and so on. But, you know, I mean, I don't know how in the world politically we can accept these views that are so, I mean, the left can't be extreme, but the right seems to be okay with going really far out there, right? Really pushing everything to as far as it can, you know, until, you know, I don't know. I'm very particular about this. I'll say one more thing. I traveled to Portland to do family stuff once in a while. I stopped, one thing I stopped doing is stopping in small towns that voted for Trump. I mean, I'm pretty upset about it. So, mm-hmm. I mean, this is me, and this is my opinion, you know. But I don't think we're talking about a normal kind of situation we're in the USA right now.
Well, you're drawing attention to the bigger issue. I'm still curious if, when it comes to a certain law that Seattle has, whether you would amend that law based on everything you've described, the political situation.
I would say based on what you just said, it makes me not want to amend that law.
Mm.
Because I think some of the ways that we are pooling people together under things that we disagree with or hate are, they feel like they're assuming too much. They feel like we're jumping to too many conclusions.
Can we, since it's the end of the hour here, can we pause that and end on a lighter note?
Please.
Depending on how you feel about mystery soda machines. I mean, I don't know.
You mean a pop machine?
We can talk about that. Seattle has had this Capitol Hill pop machine, if you will, Monica Guzman,
yeah.
Soda machine. And then
that soda machine has always been here.
It's on Google Maps. You have like 3.6 stars on it, and it's a tourist attraction.
It changed to just mystery soda on each selection.
And I think that made it fun, because you never knew what you were getting.
Coke and
a diet soda.
Mostly cream sodas I've gotten.
Or some store brand Bobo.
You never knew what you was gonna get out of it.
One time I got a sparkling water. I was so mad.
It's a mystery machine run by a mystery person.
But now it's gone. This is the mystery. Those are Capitol Hill residents telling King 5 how much it meant to them that for years there's been this pop machine. On East John, off Broadway. It was always stocked. Nobody knew by whom. You didn't know what
pop machine
pop you were about to get. And if the machine's gone missing with a note that says went for a walk, what happened to it?
Okay, what happened to it, though? This is the thing that drives me crazy about this pop machine, mm-hmm. which is that it's at one of the busiest intersections in Seattle. I used to live one block away from there. We walk by it all the time. I've never seen anyone filling it. And it's right across from the light rail station. How did no one see someone take it? It's big. You'd have to cart it into a truck or something.
I'm going
to
call BS on the fact that people say nobody knows who it is. Mm. Somebody knows.
Somebody knows.
Somebody knows. Somebody who works there knows. And it's just a fun little well-kept secret because it's fun, you know, and it's harmless. But
Charles, you're smiling like you know.
Oh, you know.
No, I know. As I said, there's an indication of the gentrification of Capitol Hill. This is another, you know, piece of evidence of how bad it's getting up there. I mean, even Coke machines, or I'm sorry, I called it a Coke machine.
Oh, man.
Are you saying the pop machine can no longer afford to live on Capitol Hill?
Look at it. It was a raggedy thing. I mean, it was an authentic, even the way it's described, the nostalgia, you know, the old Seattle, kind of random, a little funky, right?
Yeah.
And now, of course, I mean, that is, we'll see pretty soon some fancy, hype, you know, machine that gives us, like, water with all sorts of nutrients in it and whatever.
Vitamins.
This is what's coming next.
We can't have funky things.
We can't have funky
things.
This is
why.
Yeah, it'll require you to use an Amazon card or something like that.
No.
It's an app.
Be made in a warehouse.
You know, an app.
All right. Well, there have been many theories that it was detained by ice, which ironically is where soda cans prefer to be, in a cold ice facility.
Oh,
some people are saying the soda tax killed it. There's a lot of theories. I think Charles Medede knows.
I think he does, too.
Yeah, please tell us.
No. I'm telling you. Yeah. It's just, you know.
That's what he says.
It couldn't afford it.
Yeah. Just look in South Seattle. You'll find it popping up there sooner
okay.
or later.
Popping.
Go, somebody tell us. We're live. Tweeting at KOW, tell us where the machine is. The
pop machine.
That's Monica Guzman, co-founder of the Evergrey newsletter. Rachel Lerman, tech writer for the Seattle Times. Charles Medede, writer for the Seattle Stranger. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for considering the week with us. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Come back again next week. Have a good weekend.